Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons. I'm Jason Ophir, here with, as always, the beautiful and talented Sherry Pang. Sherry, how's it going?
Hey, Jason. How's it going with you? I heard you're kind of threw your back out a little bit.
Yeah, not fun. I was building a new computer setup and, you know, got the whole virtual reality Oculus Rift thing and Alienware computer, and then went and got a big monitor. And when I was setting the monitor up, aggravated an old injury. And when that happens, it basically, I'm totally immobile. I mean, the pain's unbearable. I can't move. And, you know, it's terrible.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I hope you feel better. And you know me, you can always call on me if you need help or something. So I'm going to introduce our new guest. He's a first time. He's never been on Paranormal Horizons. His name is Jeff Davis. And the guy has been on as recently on the Dead Files. And I would like to ask a couple questions about that, but he's been on Coast to Coast AM with George Nuri a few times, and also on Haunted History. So, yes, he is has a guided tour called something about the Vancouver Barracks, and I've never been to the Vancouver Barracks. Have you, Jason?
No, I haven't personally gone, but I've heard that there's some paranormal activity that goes on there. Somebody told me about it quite some time ago, but it's pretty interesting. I think it's just right over the Columbia River. Like, you can see it once you get over, across I-5 or something, or 205. No, it was I-5. I think it's right
there
I-5? On the right. But
okay.
I could be wrong.
Oh, I don't think I've ever been there myself, but that's going to be quite interesting. You know, to go and check it out. So he does these tours over there, and he knows about the history. And it's going to be, you know, we're going to talk about just mainly all kinds of things, from his paranormal experience to, you know, this book that he's had with the haunted tour guide in the Pacific Northwest. That'd be kind of interesting. And like I said, I would like to talk to him about his exposure, what happened with the Dead Files. That's something that I used to follow on the show, but I've been so busy, I don't know, for the last year I haven't been able to follow them. So we're going to put him on.
All right, we'll get him on right now.
Hello, Jason.
Hey,
how are you doing?
Good. Thank you for coming on our show.
It's a great pleasure.
So, anyway, we wanted to talk to you. First of all, I have personal questions. What were you on the Dead Files? Well, I saw in your one of your posts that you were with Steve. What is this? His last name? Chavi? How do you pronounce his name?
Deshavi.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, did they show up there up in Washington?
Well, I was on four different episodes of the show. And the first episode that I was on, I cannot remember which season, but the setting of this was in a place in Vancouver, Washington, called Esther Short Park.
Yes, I've been there quite a bit. How about you, Jason?
Nope, never heard of it.
Oh, no. Jason, you're going to have to come across the river sometime.
I don't get over to that side very much, but I'm going to have to. I've been so busy with work. I need to get back out into the paranormal and start doing investigations again and stuff. I do kind of miss it, but I'm sure there's a lot of great historic places around here that would be really fun to check out.
Yes. Yeah, there are. And I'm not the only one who knows all of Vancouver's history. There are a bunch of people who know more, but I've got my own kind of little niche, little paranormal history, a little military history, and I have fun doing it too.
Well, I was in Esther Short Park probably a few months ago with the Hawaiian Polynesian Fair, and I've been there a couple times, and I didn't even know they even went up there in that park there.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting story about that. Since you've been there, Sherry, you know how there's that kind of Victorian house kind of off in the corner of the park.
Yes.
That's the Slocum House, and that originally stood about a block away, and that was one of these mansions that was built in the late 1800s, of course, for the Slocum family. And during some urban renewal in the 1960s, they physically picked it up and moved it to where it is now in the park. And it has been many different things over the years. Currently, it's an artist's gallery, but for many years it was a theater, and it was in that theater period that they noticed that the place was haunted.
Oh,
what kind
wow.
of activity were they reporting there?
Well, the wife of the owner, I can't remember her first name right now, but Mrs. Slocum, never had children, and they tried several times. And among other things, she used to throw parties, birthday parties, for all of the kids when they had their birthdays, and she would kind of preside over it and make sure the cake and ice cream and everything were set out. And in later years, when it became a theater, in particular, when they did these little Saturday matinees with the little kids' plays, people claimed to have seen her standing on or about stage or looking at the kids. And she's only one of the ghosts in the house.
Hmm.
Wasn't sure whether to keep on going about the other ghosts or not. Unfortunately for you, I can talk for hours without stopping, so I'm paused.
You have the floor.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to ask real quick. Now, Sherry did mention the dead fowls and stuff and kind of gave a brief introduction. I was hoping that maybe you could kind of let the listeners know a little bit more in depth about, you know, who you are and some of the things you've done.
Sure. Of course, my name is Jeff Davis, and all of a sudden I pause. My more mundane life, I worked as an archaeologist for a number of years. I have degrees in anthropology and archaeology, and I used to work for the Forest Service. Kind of parallel to that, I spent over 30 years in the Army and Army Reserves, and I spent some time on active duty, was mobilized and sent to Bosnia for about 9 months, and then after September 11th, I was mobilized twice, serving as a military historian. And mixed in with that, because I am one of these people who believes, like an anthropologist, it's okay to think and talk about ghosts and to examine them and the traditions and just to talk to people. And that's how I got interested in publishing books on the paranormal. And I've written or contributed to a dozen books. My bestseller was published by Sterling Publishing. It was called Weird Washington. I wrote 9 chapters out of that book and 6 chapters out of Weird Oregon. And some of that has led to appearances on TV shows, such as The Dead Files. I got a call from them when they were researching Esther Short Park, because it's not just the Slocum House that's haunted, the park itself. Even though it's a city park now, in the old pioneer days, there actually was a shootout, and a man named Amos Short shot and killed 2 other men defending his family plot there. And so I went around with them and helped set up for that episode. And another 3 times when they've come to the Pacific Northwest, they've needed a historian consultant to talk about the past of the area where they've been investigating, including Concrete, Washington, and up near Olympia as well. This year, in August, they aired the episode that they filmed. Again, it had associations with some of the Indian Wars of the 1850s up near Olympia.
Now, do you do paranormal investigations, or is it more of like just a historical kind of research?
I can and do paranormal investigations, but I really find myself liking the historic research about hauntings, if only because that way I don't have to stay up till 4 or 5 in the morning monitoring my gizmos.
I'm with you on that. I think I'm starting to get too old for that. I work in the evening. I work some days till 2 a.m. in the morning and, you know, not doing anything paranormal. I work in a medical laboratory, and, man, it's rough. Let me tell you. I'm no spring chicken, but it's hard working that late shift, so I'm with you on that. So it sounds like, I mean, I really admire, you know, your historical background. I love archaeology. I love stuff like that and learning the history, because history is so fascinating, especially in dealing with historic sites. It's really amazing some of the information you can come across. What, through your historical research, I mean, what's your personal opinion on ghosts? I assume you believe they exist. Do you have any theories on them or any personal experiences?
Well, I try and treat it scientifically, but not to the exclusion of everything else. A good scientist would tell you that you cannot prove ghosts exist, but then again, you cannot prove they don't exist. It's describing it, investigating it. That's a whole technique to it, and I do believe in the possibility they exist. I'm not a physicist, but I like to try and think in terms of physicists. They're trying to explain things. For instance, there's one theory that that time does not flow in a linear fashion, that it's like a river, and it has currents and it has eddies, and it will kind of sometimes go back on itself like a river does, and that perhaps we, being three-dimensional beings, in time being the fourth dimension, we cannot really perceive how time passes correctly. We're in one spot in one time, and there is a flow of events through time, and somehow it gets a little thin, and we can see forward and backward in time. And because we imperfectly perceive time, because that's the nature of our bodies, that we're actually looking across time, but we think of it as a ghost or a haunting.
Wow.
And I'm open to that. I mean, one of these physicists believes that the entire universe is just some kind of laser hologram and that we're all computer programs. I find it easier to believe that ghosts exist rather than we're all part of a hologram myself.
I've heard that before, and that's kind of scary if we're some sort of computer program or brain in a vat sort of thing. I hope that's not the case, because for me, I mean, that sounds pretty terrifying. But it sounds like what you're talking about kind of is a lot of like the quantum mechanics kind of thing, and I'm totally into all that.
Mm-hmm. I wish we had one of these dry erase boards where we could understand the old diagrams. It might make it easier, I guess.
Yeah.
Or not. But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
Oh no, I was. Now I lost my thought.
Oh
no.
I was going to ask if you had had, you know, doing these walkthroughs at various locations, if you've had any personal experiences, a scene or felt or experienced anything that kind of validated maybe some of the things that you've learned in the past through historical research or what people tell you about hauntings and stuff.
Yes, yes. Most recently, of course, I've been working on doing these ghost walks. Actually, the company, the official name is Spirit Tales of the Vancouver Barracks, and it is a guided tour, in sometimes in daytime, sometimes at night, around the military barracks. And the time period for the barracks is 1849 to the present day, and I grew up around there. And so I have a lot of history, and yes, I have had experiences in and around several of the buildings. And most recently, this time of year, of course, it gets dark earlier and earlier. So I fitted together a couple of poles, and at night on the poles I hang lanterns, and they're battery powered. Of course, a little small, like little emergency lanterns. One of them is an LED lantern. The other one is a regular incandescent bulb. And last night was the third night that I had used them. And the first night, I put brand new batteries in both lanterns. And when I stopped in front of two of my little haunted spots, one of the lanterns, the light started flickering and getting dimmer and dimmer. And then when we left and started walking to the location, the light came up to full power again. And that happened in two different places. And the second night, which was this last Friday, it flickered on one of the same two locations, and the other lamp completely lost power. The batteries were completely dead after less than 2 hours. And last night, I put brand new batteries in both lamps again, and about three quarters of the way through the walk, the lamp again, the batteries died. And I'm pretty certain that these batteries should last longer than 2 hours, but that's just me.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Spirits.
Yeah.
That's
now,
like if you have one battery that goes out, okay, yeah, maybe it's just a bunk battery, but you have multiple batteries go multiple times, it kind of raises an eyebrow.
Yeah, and the batteries came from two different packages of batteries, so it's not like they were part of the same lot of batteries that were sold. They could have all been made wrong. And so that, to people who are scientifically minded, and you look at, by analogy, gizmos the batteries tend to get drained around haunted locations. And so I thought, if that's a coincidence, it's a pretty pretty interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
Sherry, go ahead.
Well, Sherry, were you going to say something?
No, go ahead. Nope, I'm fine.
Now, that's not the only thing, and these are, of course, the most recent happenings. This is not including my original experiences, but we were standing on the porch of one of these haunted buildings, and this was about 3 weeks ago, and it was daylight, and as I was talking about the haunt, and in particular the haunted basement of this building, we could actually hear and feel, standing on the wooden porch, there was this tapping as if it came from underneath the porch. It was loud enough to hear and strong enough to feel the vibrations through our shoes. And there were, surrounding the porch, there were a series of air vents and ventilation vents. And so one of the people climbed down off the stairs and looked underneath the porch through the vents, and even, I believe, got out a little flashlight and showed the flashlight under there, and there was nobody hiding under the porch playing a joke on us.
Wow.
Yes, it was, to use somebody else's phrase, it was way cool.
Has there ever
that
been any,
to
like...
me when I was in Hawaii, and we were on a Hawaiian tour over in Maui, and we were up by the, some kind of valley, and we were doing a ghost walk, and all the batteries were, you know, all brand new. They always start every night when they do a ghost tour with brand new batteries, and mine was the only one that was drained. So, you know, it's kind of like, okay, you know, like Jason said, sometimes, you know, when you have one, it could be just a fluke, or, you know, I experience, as a psychic medium, I experience a lot of paranormal in the Hawaiian Islands, and it's amazing how their spirits are very strong, and they come across very much, they're very much with the land and the people, very much so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some associations, because before the Army arrived, the U.S. Army arrived in 1849, from the 1820s to the 1850s, the British Hudson's Bay Company were there, and they were employers of, they were an international consortium. They had employees from Hawaii, the South Pacific, and from North America, from the East Coast to the West Coast, a lot of native folk. And some of the stories are associated with the old cemetery that the Catholic missionaries set up. And the cemeteries, many of the graves are still there, even though they are now unmarked. And people claim to have had odd and unusual happenings around that cemetery as well.
What are some other notable places in the Portland, Vancouver area that are reputed to be haunted? If I ever wanted to to go out and conduct an investigation. Where are some places I might be interested in going? Now, I've done the White Eagle, which was connected to the Shanghai tunnels, and I had some experiences there. That's a great place. But I never really did a lot of research into, you know, other locations, because mostly when I was doing investigations, it was at, like, people's houses. But I'm not really aware of what some of other historical locations are there are around here.
Sure. You, of course, when you mentioned the White Eagle, you already picked my first recommendation. The McMenamins family seem to have a talent for picking not just great kind of unusual, unique historic buildings, but they seem to have a knack for picking haunted locations as well. In the Portland area, you know, just east of Portland in Troutdale is the Edgefield, the old Multnomah County poorhouse. And I've been there many times, and it's a great location to stay. And if you can keep your hands off the beer mugs, it's a great location to do paranormal investigating as well. Let's face it, a poorhouse is really a place of sadness, and it's a time for people to leave behind memories of longing and you know, sadness. And is so haunted to the point where if you go visit there, you can ask at the front desk to see the ghost log. There's an actual log book where guests have put in notations or written statements about experiences in their rooms.
It's funny you mentioned, I forgot the other place. This Paranormal Horizons has actually done a live broadcast from the most haunted room at the Edgefield out there in Troutdale. We did that one time.
The Amazing Grace room?
I don't remember the name of the room. Apparently there's like, I want to say this was a while ago, there was like some demon dog and some occult stuff that was on the floor. But it was whatever room was reputed to be the most haunted. And you know, we had cameras set up all over the place and everything, and we did our broadcast, and absolutely nothing happened. So we didn't go on a good night. But I wanted to tell you what happened when we did the White Eagle was different. Sorry if I'm grunting, it's because I'm having in pain. So the White Eagle, when we went there, it was I had just gone up and we had rented, I don't remember what the room number was, but it was reputed to be the most haunted room. And the second I walked in the room, it was like walking in a wall. I just felt like fear and dread, and the air was thick. And I was thinking to myself, once I walked in the room, I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to stay in this room overnight. And so I put my stuff down, went down, had lunch, came back to the room, and there was absolutely, the room felt totally fine. And that, to me, you know, a personal experience like that kind of validates it to me, because whatever was going on in that room was gone when we got back there. But the one thing that did happen that night at the White Eagle was we were sitting there, it was the middle of the night, and heard somebody walking down the staircase from the, you know, where we were, it was like the second floor or whatever. And it's really loud, and the stairs are really loud, and our door is like right there by the staircase. So as soon as we heard somebody walking down the stairs, open up the door, there's nobody there. And it's a super long staircase, so it's not like somebody can just run away. I mean, so it was like we're all like scratching our heads, and got that on audio. It was really strange.
I'm glad you got it on audio. As you know, that's the hardest thing, is to capture it, one, to have witnesses with you, as well as capturing it so that you can play this thing back for other people to see or hear. Very haunted location. You were probably staying in room 2 or room 3. Those are the two most haunted rooms. Yeah. What's interesting about the White Eagle is, of course, the bar owners used to live there. And so rooms 1 and 2 have an adjoining door, because that was their apartment. One was, you know, one half of it was their living room. The other room was their bedroom. And that room, room 2 and room 3, are the only rooms in the White Eagle that have a built-in closet. And
wow.
The rest of the rooms, they would have just had like a little wardrobe in them, if that, because they were, you know, rented by the night. And so room 3 was probably the room used by Sam, who's their resident ghost. And Sam lived there for a couple of decades before, depending on, it's unclear, he either, they were going to evict him because they were condemning the upper floor, or he got sick and he died in the hospital. I'm not really clear. The stories aren't clear about how it happened, but his room also had a closet. And when the McMenamins fixed the place up, they kind of redid the closets and redid the paneling and the walls on them. But it's, it is, yeah.
It was definitely room 3 because it didn't have, like, another door. And I do remember the closet in there. But it's such a creepy place.
It is, and I was in there. The owner who owned it before the McMenamins let me walk around there before they did any of the rehabilitation. And in those days, he did not go up to that upper floor very often because it was haunted. He would go up a couple times a year because that's where the controls for the heating and air conditioning system were. And when he would go up on visits, sometimes he would find the doors to the rooms open. Oftentimes, when Sam left, when a lot of people left, they left clothing and other items behind, and he would find clothing move. Sam's clothing would be moved from room 3 to some of the other rooms and back between visits.
Hmm. What's the history of the Edgefield, the one out in... Troutdale. I don't know much about it. I know that they, like you had mentioned the ghost log. I remember seeing that, and I didn't remember the room number, but it was. I remember it was the most haunted one, or the ones that they said it was the most haunted one. And but I don't know the history of why. I know it was, but you said like a poor farm or something. But I don't know the history of like that room we were staying in, why it was haunted.
Yeah, here's my chance for have people to be listening and then calling in and saying, Jeff, you got it wrong. So this is from my memory, and I may be getting some factoids wrong. But the building was built as the Multnomah County Poorhouse, and it was a tradition in America and in Europe for centuries that various communities in the days before the social welfare programs, every community would have people who were old, who didn't have any descendants, and so they would lose everything. And the way the community took care of them, and orphans and indigent people, would be they would set aside land, arable land, farmable land, and they would set up a series of buildings on it, and they would move the poor people onto it, and they would have to contribute and work a couple hours a day. In the case of like old women, they would have them do ironing or knitting for customers, and men might well have to farm or cook or process other things. And in between that and farming land with hired labor, hopefully it would become a paying concern. In the case of the Edgefield, there's a county lockup. I think it's the county lockup, the little mini jail, not too far away. It's on the edge of the grounds. And they were able to hire convict labor to work the land. And from all the produce sold, they actually made quite a bit of money. And that's why the expansion is in brick. And they actually kept it going for many, many decades. And eventually they did shut it down. And the McMenamins came through a couple times trying to figure out whether they were going to buy it. And when they did, of course, in the years that it was vacant, people had broken in. And in one of the second floor rooms, when they went in to finally start clearing the place out, they did. They found a room with a pentagram drawn on the floor and candles, half-burned candles, and a couple of dead birds in there as well. And when they rehabilitated the building and opened the rooms up for tenants, they tried to counteract that. So the artist McMenamins had decorating the place, they painted angels on the ceiling to kind of counterbalance the pentagram on the floor. And there are angels on the walls, and it's called the Amazing Grace Room. And they had bagpipers come in and play Amazing Grace to kind of exorcise anything bad out of it.
That was definitely the room.
And on the door there are pictures of the pipers piping and little musical notes and things, if I recall correctly. And I do remember talking to the staff, and early on people complained that there was a little black dog in the room, to the point where it would jump on the bed with people and nuzzle them with his cold nose. And one of the guests managed to get out a bed and like lock the dog in his room and ran down to the front desk and complained, you know, you let this dog into my room, get it out. And they followed him up and went into the room. And of course there was no dog there. And this happened several times, and I stayed there myself, and there was some activity. Sometimes they would make the beds, getting ready for clientele. And a lot of people don't realize this. In some of these rooms, they actually store linen in some of these cabinets, extra linen.
Wow.
And on one of my visits, I was the guest that day. They had made up the room, and they went to get the housekeeper to inspect the rooms. And when they came into that room, all the linen on the bed had been torn off. Not only that, all of the linen in the cupboard had been pulled out of the cupboard and thrown about the room. It's like it knew I was coming.
Yeah.
Have you ever
definitely...
been touched, Jeff, on any of your...
Touched? I've had just about everything happen to me, except I've never ever seen an apparition. But, I felt the breath in the back of the neck, kind of electric tingling, cold spots, hot spots, kind of a little touchy feeling as well, yes.
Have you ever experienced what I was talking about when I went to the White Eagle, where you walk into a room and the air's thick and it's just really, really uncomfortable?
I have. I'm not very psychic, but when I go to locations that are very, very active, even people like me can feel this kind of thing, yes. And you don't know why. It just is. This sensation,
yeah.
I shouldn't be here.
It's so, so strange. So we do have a caller. Do you want to take maybe the caller ask some questions?
Sure.
All right. Caller, you're live on Paranormal Horizons. Who's this?
Hi, this is Joe from Hawaii.
Hey,
hi,
Joe.
Joe. How are you?
Hello, Joe.
Hi. I've had the pleasure of being on your show as well. This is a fantastic show, and I find this whole conversation extremely intriguing. My question to you is, you mentioned earlier a little bit about time anomalies and time being the fourth dimension and that kind of stuff. Have you personally experienced any kind of like time anomalies or transportation stories or anything like that?
Yes, peripherally. There's a place in southern Oregon near the Oregon-California border called the Oregon Vortex. And the people who are there, you know, some of what they do, they've got a building where, a baseball rolls uphill, that kind of stuff. But they also believe that there's an electromagnetic anomaly that does affect time. And I was in there in their gift shop, and they didn't know who I was. They were almost kind of doing their own thing. One of the guides came in and talked to the gift shop woman and said, you know, I did the experiment again. And she said, what? And he said, I got the watches. And apparently he had a handful of pocket watches or wrist watches, and he synchronized them all and set them all at the same time, and then he put them in a line through their vortex from the inside to the outside of the vortex, and then he left and came back an hour later, and they all had different times on them.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm into the paranormal, and that's been something that I've been studying and trying to learn a lot from. That's a very interesting way to do tests. I've heard stories of people at places that I frequent being teleported into completely different areas. Like, we start off, we're in this scary rainforest woods kind of thing in the middle of the night. My friends, they were walking down, they turn around, and all of a sudden they're in this garden of flowers for 15 minutes. Walking around this whole field of flowers, and there's two of them, and they have no idea where on earth they are. They're walking around, looking around. 15 minutes later, they turn around, and they're back in the trail at the middle of the forest in the middle of the night. I've heard three separate accounts at this one place. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's entirely likely, and in some cases, it seems almost fortuitous, almost like something's helping. As a, for instance, I had two people come to a book signing, and so I did not know them. So you have to take some of this with a grain of salt. But they were talking about how they were driving from Vancouver, which is Vancouver, Washington, and they needed to go east through the gorge in Oregon. They needed to go, I want to say, to Pendleton. And they were running late, and they were kind of complaining and really had a lot of anxiety because they needed to go see family. And they went through an underpass. They were headed south. They went through an underpass, and they came out the other side of the underpass, transported under an underpass on I-84, already driving in eastern Oregon, or through the Columbia River Gorge, rather. And they had, and their watches had the correct time. They didn't lose radio at all. They had the correct time, but they had moved physically about 40 miles in the space of time it took them to get through the underpass. And so they arrived before they were supposed to.
Huh.
What does it all mean? I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, that. I don't know what to think about that. That's just kind of, you know, scary.
Yeah, and that was not, they were not there, and I was not talking about lost time episodes. That was just something that, you know, we had been talking about, quote, normal paranormal experiences, you know, ghosts and that kind of stuff. And then they kind of like nudged each other and said, you tell him. No, you tell him. And so they were also puzzled about that, too. People don't tend to think about that physics, the lost time kind of stuff. Is anything to do with quote ghosts in that part of the paranormal. Usually they think of that as, yeah, there must have been a UFO involved.
That's what I would think. Aliens. It's always aliens. If I can't explain something, aliens.
Like the guy from the Weekly World News. I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
One more question, then I'll go off the air, but if you don't mind, how are you able to detect, what kind of methods have you heard of, have you used in ways that you can find these time anomalies? You mentioned the watches and the electromagnetic fields and stuff. Is there anything that you've heard of as well? Because I'm trying to conduct this, like, testing and stuff. And I'll share with you that my studies have led me to go to look up ley lines and astronomy in conjunction together, called archaeoastronomy, I've heard, where a certain star sets on the horizon and everything in line with that star is active for a few minutes.
I would not be surprised about that, but I am also, since you're in Hawaii, you know all about geomagnetic activity and volcanoes and earthquakes. They're here in the Cascade Mountains, you know, we've got Mount St. Helens, Mount Hood. We've got all these high peaks that are still active. And part of the phenomena of the energy released from the Earth's core to the surface, I remember researching incidents of, I think it was ball lightning that took place in earthquake zones, as if, you know, just the friction at the deep in the Earth's crust moving upward created electromagnetic energy that was released as ball lightning or ground lightning. And when you got, if you're going to be doing time traveling, it has to take energy to do that. If physics tie into the paranormal, And so I would tend to hang out in areas that have documented high electromagnetic energy readings, high earthquake incidences. Maybe this is why our ancestors used to believe that trees struck by lightning became magical.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for answering my questions, too.
Hey, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for calling, Joe.
Take care, guys.
Yes, thank you.
I find it all fascinating. I mean, I've heard stories of people being teleported. It just, I think it's just too much for my brain to comprehend. It's just wild. But I suppose it's an amazing world that we live in, and anything's possible. I don't doubt that those things happen. I mean, the first thing, of course, that comes to your mind when you hear stories is, oh, somebody's on drugs. But I don't necessarily think that's the case, because strange things happen all the time.
Yes. You know, I keep on using the word paranormal, and that's kind of unfair. I'm struggling with vocabulary, but let's face it, in the 1600s, if you would have told somebody that you could recreate the same energy as lightning and then use that energy to move a portable room built inside of a standing building up and down, they'd say you were crazy. But we know that is an elevator, you know, and it's same thing. All these bullet trains running on, you know, suspended by electromagnetic radiation. They never actually touch anything, and yet we're able to move vast distances and weights. So paranormal may well be scientific process that we just don't understand. We don't have the vocabulary to explain.
I got a question, and it's kind of a little bit off topic, but since you were into archaeology, I keep reading these stories about, you know, people working in rock quarries, finding stuff that doesn't, you know, like batteries that are like 30 million years old or something, or some sort of technology that didn't exist and it's been in the ground so long that it's in rock. You know what I'm talking about?
Kind of. And I've seen vague pictures. I know when something's posted on the internet is true, because that's just the way things are. You know, everything on the internet is true.
The
stuff. I can't speak for supposed batteries that have been there so long that lava flows covered over the top of them. Having said that, I do know that from ancient Egypt, von Däniken was right. The people did make wet cell batteries, where there's a clay pot, and inside the clay pot there's usually an iron rod and some copper wire coming off of it, and the residue of acids of some kinds. And we do know that the ancient Egyptians did have batteries, but they didn't power a mechanical device with them. They knew how to gold and silver plate metals, and so they used the batteries in a metal plating process. They were technology. Technology exists, but what use people put it to isn't necessarily what we would use it for. They were a lot more clever than we give them credit for in some cases. And so there may have been these ancient complex societies whose remains are buried underneath, say, the Sahara Desert or in Antarctica. I'm all for that too. Sorry, I was walking around my front living room waving into the air. I'm sorry.
Well, it's because I think the most recent one I heard was, I think it was in China. They dug up this tomb that's thousands of years old, and they opened it up. And then I don't remember exactly what they found, but it was clearly out of place, you know, and, you know, for the time period. But you're right. I don't trust anything I see on the internet. It's hard to know what to believe anymore because there's so much fakery out there. Do you know what I'm talking about, Sherry?
Definitely. I you know, it's interesting when you read things, or you know, you don't know if they're legit, and it's just like on our posts, whether you know, Paranormal Horizons, it's not necessarily our thoughts or our beliefs or anything, but it's just a variety of things that could be out there. Is it possibly true or not? But, you know, it's up to the viewer's discretion. Is that correct? I don't know. Anything's possible, but like you said, you don't know if it's true or not. And hopefully, you know, some people have some integrity and are going to be honest and not make things up and things like that. So.
Yeah,
hey,
and
Jeff,
when I encounter those.
Have you ever been to the Shanghai Kennels in Portland, Oregon?
Well, it's funny you mention that. How about this? Yes and no.
Okay.
You know, the tunnel network extended quite a bit through Portland. And so I have been down there a couple times. I have not been on the very popular Shanghai Tunnel tours set up by the Kaski Geographic Society. I had not been through those. But a couple of years ago, I designed a ghost walk for a company called Portland Walking Tours, and it's called the Beyond Bazaar Tour. And so I was down there in the tunnels for that, as well as above ground walking around Portland. I had a clairvoyant friend, and we just kind of walked the streets, and she did cold reads, and then we would stop, and I would investigate the historic background on that the various buildings. And it was it was quite interesting. The tour owner, I think, was a bit skeptical of psychics until we got done with that, and he admitted he himself couldn't quantify what it was, but belief in clairvoyance and psychics was not quite so silly to him after that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story behind the Shanghai tunnels? I mean, I've heard bits and pieces about people would go to the bars back in the day and they would get drugged and then forced on ships, but I don't really know any much more history about it.
Sure. Most of that whole tunnel network, there actually are a couple different tunnel networks that are interconnected. The oldest tunnels were actually dug out into the side bank of the Willamette River on the west side because everything was so wet and there weren't streets like we know them today. A lot of the merchants just paid to have tunnels dug, or they excavated trenches and then covered over the top of them, and that went from the docks into Portland itself, mostly to transport commerce. You know, unload the ships and carry stuff through the tunnels where it was dry, rather than above ground where it could get wet or people could steal it. So during the daytime, a lot of that area in those tunnels was used for legitimate business practices. Nighttime, in some of the areas, slightly different story, because these tunnels ran, and eventually on top of them they built sidewalks. And so they ran and had openings through the tunnel network into the basements of a lot of buildings. And that's where the Shanghaiing part comes into play, where some of the buildings close to the docks were saloons. And it was pretty easy to get sailors drunk or get men drunk and take them into the basements and then kind of store them there and keep them drugged and then move them through the tunnels to the docks where the ships were waiting. But that was not the tunnels themselves were not dug specifically to kidnap people.
That was
a lucky side benefit.
So they would just find themselves on a boat, and I guess there's nothing you can do if you're out in the middle of the ocean. So it's just kind of like forced labor. Do they even get paid anything?
Yes. Yeah, there were ships articles, and this was kind of the nefarious scheme behind this. If you happen to be somebody, there was one guy. They called him crimps, C-R-I-M-P. A crimp was a person who kind of went around and collected these guys, got them drunk or drugged, and then in their drug state, he would have them sign an agreement making him their agent to find employment. And he actually operated. One guy is named Bunko Kelly. And Bunko Kelly operated a rooming house, and that's where he found his victims. And so he would get their drunken signature or forged signature on a document that said, "This is my agent. He's going to find me a job." And Bunko Kelly would then go to the ship's captain and say, "I represent the following men. who want to go on a sea voyage. So he would sign articles with the ship's captain. He would collect the pay in advance, and out of that advance pay, he would purchase from himself all the equipment the sailor needed, you know, clothing, shoes, rope, what have it. And so these guys would wake up basically with no money in their pocket, but a complete set of seamen's clothing and gear. And they had signed articles to go on a sea voyage for a certain length. You know, usually it's a round trip. So I'm going from Portland to Shanghai, China and back. And that's about a 2-year voyage. And so the crimps were the ones who really made it rich, because they collected a fee as an agent. They also collected money by, quote, selling the sailor all the equipment they needed for the sea voyage.
Were there any laws against this? Was there any, like, crackdown, or it was just, they just got away with it with impunity?
You know, Portland's history, you know, they kind of turned a blind eye to a lot of it, so long as nobody died. And even after some of the people died, I mean, let's face it, some of these people who were Shanghaied away never actually made it back to Portland to complain. Others did, but the crimp would have their signature on a paper document saying, see, they signed articles, I'm protected under the law. And it was kind of necessary, they felt, because these ships, they needed the sailors. If they didn't have the sailors, the ships wouldn't sail. If the ships didn't sail, then all the cargo that they were supposed to take out or bring back never occurred. And Portland made its money by being a shipping point for things like wheat to Asia, and coming back from Asia, silk and other products. And so I think the times that they were in, a lot of the people could be bribed or just turn a blind eye. They didn't want to get involved, or they were on the payroll.
I imagine it'd be hard to get away with that today. Maybe not.
Would. It would. Well, and Bunko Kelly himself was put in jail a couple times, and a couple times he got off, but eventually he went to jail associated with a murder, and he was in jail for, I think 12 years, a significant amount of time. And by the time he got out, the laws about crimping, about agents for sailors and that kind of stuff, they had changed. It took federal laws to do that. Furthermore, you needed those sailors on sailing ships. And by World War I, most of the ships were using engines and propellers, and so there was less of a need for sailors. So it was starting to die off anyway.
Oh, I guess that makes total sense. Yeah, as technology improves, I guess you don't need sailors. That's a good point. Or as many.
Or not as many, yeah.
Oh.
So anyway, I have friends who do tours of the underground, and it's extremely interesting to hear them talk about it, kind of on their side of the block. It is kind of interesting. Some of those tunnels are still there. In addition to those commerce tunnels, there are utility tunnels where the city, even to today, still has to run phone lines and electric lines and all this kind of stuff. And in some places, there were steam heat plants, where they were on one block and they had steam pipes that ran underground to various buildings, and they sold steam for heat to the buildings. So there are different tunnels.
Hmm. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to give listeners an opportunity to hear if they can contact you or get your books, or if they can learn more about the various tours and stuff like that.
Sure. My website is one word. It's ghostsandcritters.com. Ghostsandcritters.com. And if I talk too fast to spell, if you actually do a Yahoo or a Google search and you type in Jeff Davis plus Oregon ghosts, I should pop up within the top 10. If you typed in Jeff Davis plus Washington goes, and you get Washington, D.C., and Thomas Jefferson and the Capitol Mall, that kind of stuff. So, but, yeah, my spirit tour is the Vancouver Barracks, running on weekends now, basically from this upcoming weekend to Halloween weekend. Like a lot of ghost walks in the Northwest, it kind of shut down a little bit for the weather. But I'll be back in June of next year. My books you can buy off my website, and I look forward to people coming and visiting and sharing stories. I've been maintaining the website for over a decade, and so I've got a listing of other people's ghost stories and my own blog, and I just welcome visitors coming and say hi.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And I know I learned a lot about the history, you know, the White Eagle, Edgefield, and Shanghai tunnels. I didn't know much about it, and I thank you for sharing that knowledge with me, and I'm sure the listeners enjoyed it. So thanks for coming on this evening.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back and talk about a little bit more about that. I would love to learn more about the history up in Washington, up your neck of the woods. And just really quickly, did you hear an interference, like a female voice talk came through when Jeff was talking? Did you hear about it? Did you just hear that, Jason, or any of you?
No, I didn't. What did you hear?
All right, I just heard it, kind of like that. It was just like very high pitch, and it's just like a woman talking very high pitch, and like, you know, it's just like that tone. So it's like, okay, some interference here going on.
No, I did not hear it, but
yes,
if Jason, if you or Sherry want
to, I wish we had a recorder. You could hear it. it was just a really fast blurb. But anyway, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you being on, and we'd like to have you back.
But what were you saying, Jeff?
I look forward
to
it. Let me know when you want to cross the river, and I'll take you both on a ghost walk around the Vancouver Barracks. Just let me know when.
I would love that.
That would be awesome.
Great.
Yes. Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Okay. Look forward to it. And thanks everybody
for
listening.
Jeff. We appreciate you. Yay. Another great guest.
All right. Bye. All righty, Sherry.
Yay! Like I said, another great guest. We're so, you know, I've been so blessed and feel each and every guest is special, and they're just, you know, phenomenal. You know, these guys that I, girls and guys that I have, they're just, you know, the top notch in their field, and they're just so down to earth, and I'm just really, really grateful to have each and every guest that we have. They take the time, and, to me, it's a win-win situation. We're helping educate the listeners and being able to share, but also, you know, it helps them too. So it's a really good thing. I really enjoy having them.
Yeah, absolutely. We get some really great guests, and I always learn something every show, you know.
Exactly. So
knowledge is power.
Next week, Jason, we're going to have, it's been a while. Well, you know, this month is my 2-year mark for being on radio with you.
Yay. Hold on. Hold on. Let me find some. Okay, here we go. Hold on.
That's good.
There you go. That was for you. Oh, no, I got
that
too.
Funny. Okay.
Wait, no,
Next week we're going to have Bill Bean. It's been a while. I have never talked to him, but I am going to be talking to him probably during the week. And reach out to Bill Bean. I don't know if anybody has heard of him. He is an exorcist. He is a spiritual minister. He's a life coach, TV star. He's been on it's just a plethora of different TV shows, from Animal Planet to the Travel Station, Sky-Fi, Discovery Channel, Lifetime, Movie Network, HBO. This guy is just phenomenal. So we're going to have Bill Bean, and you've had him on your show before I came on board. So, yes, lucky to have him. It's been a long time. He's a busy guy, but, you know, he would love to be back and, you know, would love to share his experiences or whatever next week at 8 o'clock.
Absolutely, yeah. Bill Bean's a great guy, great guest. Been on the show, I think, a couple times. In fact, I have a little audio bite here I'll play to end the show with Bill Bean. Unless you have anything else, well, I guess we'll see everybody next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time. Do you have anything else, Sherry?
Yes, everybody stay safe. Just be warm and, you know, take care. Peace. Love you guys.
Have a good week, everyone.
Hi, this is Bill Bean, the spiritual warrior, deliverance minister, exorcist, star of House of the Dead, author of Dark Force. For more info and updates, please visit www.billjbean.com. And if anyone out there is in need of spiritual assistance, I'll stand for you.